Hello, everyone, and thank you for coming to this last session of the day. My name is Holly Hedegaard, and I'm an injury epidemiologist at the National Center for Health Statistics. And this session is a little bit different one. It's our typical annual sort of roundtable discussion that we have on injury data issues, so injury and emergency medicine data issues. It's a little different than some of the other sessions in that we really actively encourage some discussion and feedback. We're going to be presenting some things that we would really like to get your opinions on and want to make sure that you're aware of. So actually, there's three of us who are going to be speaking today. All of us are from CDC. Margaret Warner and myself are from the National Center for Health Statistics. And then our first speaker is Lee Annist, who's from the National Center of Injury Prevention and Control. So with that, I think, Lee, I'll let you come and go ahead and talk about the Whiskers application. I've seen it. I think it's fabulous. And I can hardly wait for Lee to demonstrate it for all of you.
Thank you, Holly. I don't know if we can dim the lights a little bit. It might help. I don't. Yeah, that dimmed. No, never, don't go to sleep. Okay. Well, last year I presented a mock-up of what we were working on in terms of a Whiskers mobile app. And this year I wanted to show you the results. We actually have the near final version, beta 3.0. And you can see I've got it loaded on my iPad, so it's ready to go. We're just going through clearance now through CDC communications office so that we can get it out on the Apple Store and all of you can enjoy it. So what I'm going to do is just kind of, if I can get this thing working. There we go. Yeah, I have nothing to disclose. Yeah, and so this first phase, we decided to go ahead and, because we have a little more real estate, we decided to go out and put it out on an Apple iPad, but we do have in mind of putting it out on different platforms, Android, Microsoft, probably BlackBerry as well. So the first year we were putting it out on the iPad, so those of you that do have iPads, if you don't have one, you should go get one so you can use this. And I think you'll enjoy it. So this is our little icon that you'll see on the app and to recognize it. I also wanted to acknowledge our staff. It takes quite a team to be able to put something like this together. And the way the approach we've taken is to award a contract with this company called BNL Consulting. They've helped us develop several of the Whiskers applications. Extremely talented group, and they know SAS, they know that we know SAS, and they know that they can transfer knowledge to us, and so it works out really well that we've been able to work with them the last few years. So they have some people working on the front end, as well as a SAS programmer on the back end to set all this up. So what happens is we give them the design, and they've been able to develop the back end and the front end, and then send it to us, and then we take it and move it to production. So that way, we feel it's a very good use of government resources because we don't have to pay a contractor to make all these little changes. We can do it ourselves. So the data in this first mobile app are going to be mortality data. We are using data from the National Center for Health Statistics, National Vital Statistics System, for the deaths. And for the mechanism by intent categories, it's the underlying cause death, and we also are including traumatic brain injury, so we're using the multiple cause data for that. We also have cost estimates in there, total lifetime and work loss costs that were developed by PIER. Thank you, Ted. Appreciate that. And actually, he's going through now and updating some of the estimates, so we're going to have more current estimates of costs of injury in the future. We did inflate these numbers in terms of 2010 prices, so they will be more current. And then we use the population data, bridge race population estimates, to calculate the rates. So it is a three-year project. This first year we'll release it on the iPad, then next year we're going to have it reformatted to work on a a smartphone so that Richard Satin can enjoy it on his phone, because he's the one that came up with the idea from the beginning to do this. So we appreciate that. In fact, a lot of the work that we've done in Whiskers is a result of people giving us ideas. So we really do appreciate the feedback. And then the third year, we're going to enhance it to work in other platforms. So now I'm going to show you some screenshots so you can see what this thing looks like. And any of you that are interested in seeing it in action, I've got it right here so you can come up after we get done with the session and you can play with it a little bit. So when you go to the Apple Store, you'll download the app and you'll see this little icon, CDC Injury Data, Whiskers. And then when you click on that, the application will come up. And you can see there's a ribbon on the top that has a bunch of pull-downs. And these are there's selected causes of injury and then different filters by sex, race, ethnicity, age group, state, and then rate types. And I'm going to kind of demonstrate some of these so you can kind of see. And then across the bottom, of course, you have a map in the middle. So there's state-level data and national data. And then there's a ribbon. There's a set of graphs across the bottom, some bar charts and trend graphs. And also these slide to the left so that you can see we can add more graphs in the future. And what I'm going to do now is just show you some of the navigation features that you have in Whiskers mobile app. If you press the little three bars in the middle graph at the bottom, you'll see that there's a little frame that pops up that allows you to expand the graph or export the image. If you export it, then you could take it and it saves it as a PNG file, and then you can email it to yourself and put it in your PowerPoint slides, and also a show data feature. So I'm going to expand this. So if we expand this graph, you can see that the map now moves down to the bottom, and then that graph comes up to the middle. And there's also hover over features, so if you touch any of the bars, it will pop up and give you some statistics about that particular bar. I want to expand this graph too to show you that we did put in a leading cause chart for those 1 to 44 years of age, because since that is the leading cause, injury is the leading cause of death for people in this age range, we thought it'd be good to have that in here. So then we have a reset button in the wheel on the right-hand side. So if you reset this, it sets it all back to all injuries. Then to just show you a little bit of control you have over the map, if you click on where it says map options, it gives you the ability to change the colors of the map. We have some multicolor sequential selections. We have some monochrome, and then we have some multi-selection divergent colors. So in this case, I just selected blue. You can see that it changes. Also, you can select a different map ranges, and these are quantiles. So if you just wanted quartiles, you would keep it as is. But if you wanted more splits of the data, 5 or 6 splits of the data, you can then change that, and it will change. And you can see that anytime you make a change in this thing, it dynamically changes everything else on all the graphs and charts that are in there for the particular filter that you're selecting. Okay, also we have a feature where you can select age-adjusted rates or crude rates. And so, like I said, whenever you select crude rates, it's going to change everything to crude rates. Okay, we're going to go back and reset this to the default again. And you can see now with the map, we also provide a way to show the data for those people that would like to go beyond just seeing the graph and would like to see the actual data. You press show data, and then on the back side it will show you the data for all the states. You can see we provided a rank on the left-hand side so you can actually rank the states. And if you click the little top of the headings at the top of the table, in this case we'll click on cost, you can see that you can sort the rankings of the states by whatever you click at the top. So you could do it by deaths or age-adjusted rates or crude rates or cost. And you can also export this file. Unfortunately, we haven't figured out a way to get it into an Excel spreadsheet yet. We're working on that. But we do have an option in the meantime. And that is that in the wheel at the top, you can pull it down and you can see you can link directly to Whiskers. And Whiskers works wonderfully well on an iPad if you're hooked up to Wi-Fi. And also, we also have a link to injury topics for people that want to get in and see what CDC is doing to prevent injuries. And so it will take you to the CDC websites. This is just as if you were to click on that link, and it would take you to Whiskers. And then if you link to injury topics, this is the page that it would take you to on the Injury Center web pages. You can see that there are various topics that you can select. Also, we provide at the bottom of the table there, you can see there are various states that also have state query systems, interactive web-based query systems, and we've listed those on here too. We think we've got all the states here that have interactive query systems, but if not, if you see your state that has one, we'll add it. So there are other states that just have static tables, and we didn't really include them, but these are the ones that, where you can get interactive data. Also, as you can see, you can pull down the filters. And this one, we've pulled down the filter on age groups and selected on 65 years and older. We had to actually collapse the year groups in order to get stable rates. We also have in here, when you drill down and you get an unstable rate, it will gray out that state if it's unstable, and also provide an asterisk on that rate so that you'll be able to tell which ones are unstable. And you can see down here at the bottom in the middle, it does reduce that graph to just that age group. So we're going to reset this again. And this shows you the causes of death that we have in here now. It's mainly just the main causes, homicide and then youth violence and suicide and youth suicide and traumatic brain injury, unintentional injury, motor vehicle traffic, and poisoning. The way that this is set up, the data is in SAS on the back end, and then it's been written in Adobe Flash Flex, and the SAS data is then brought over into a local data store in SQLite files, so everything is self-contained on here. And that's what makes it run so fast. So it's actually a pretty good size data set, but these people figured out a way to get it down so that we don't have to go out and hit on the CDC website, which would slow this whole thing down. So the way that the back end is set up in SAS, we can add causes. We can update the data to more current years. So as soon as we get the ICD, or as soon as we get the NVSS 2011 data, will shift the data up. Right now, the maps are based on 2008 to 2010 data, but when we get the 2011 data, we'll shift it up to 2009 through 2011. Many of you are probably wondering when that data is going to become available, and I haven't gotten NCHS to tell me when it's going to be available yet. Maybe Margie can tell you more about that. Okay, so So let's just select suicide, for instance, and you can see there's another graph that pops up. It's a set of pie charts down on the left-hand side, which gives you information on mechanism of suicide. And let's say that we wanted to look at a particular state, the state of Arizona. And so we click on Arizona, and that changes those pie charts just to Arizona and, of course, all the other graphs too. And then if we wanted to, we could then expand that up above, and the map would drop down in its place below. And let's say we wanted to filter on sex. We would then, if we wanted to just look at males, we could then select males. It would just give us the male pie chart. And then if we wanted to compare that state, Arizona, with, say, California, you can press on California in the lower map on the left-hand side, and it will give you the pie chart. Unfortunately, we haven't figured out a way to get two states up on there at one time, so you do have to kind of flip back and forth, but at least you can get comparison states. Okay, we're going to reset this again, and this time we'll select unintentional motor vehicle traffic. Most of you know that motor vehicle traffic rates have come down in recent years, so I just kind of wanted to show you that we do have a trend graph in here. So we'll bring up a trend graph, and you can see there's a pull down for state. Since it's hard to put your finger on states like Rhode Island, we decided we would put a pull down for state so that you can select the smaller states using that. On this example, I've just selected South Carolina. And so here again, you have a hover over that gives you information about that state. And then if we go down and we expand the trend graph at the bottom, you can see that we can see the trends. And you can actually press on the trend graph on the data points, and it will give you a pop-up so you can actually see the data, the trend data from the beginning to the end. Or again, you can press on the three bars at the top and you can show data and see the whole trend. So that gives you a quick overview of what to expect, and we hope to have this out in January. We're just in the process of getting it through clearance now at CDC, so hopefully we'll get it out there and you all can enjoy it. It's really for your use and teaching your students a nice overview of injuries, or also your colleagues, and also policymakers if you wanted to give them a quick overview of injury by state. So we hope that you'll enjoy it, and we're looking forward to your feedback so that we can make changes to make it more useful for you in the future. So thank you. Yes. That's correct. It will just save it in your photo album, and then you just take it and you email it to yourself, and then you can save it as an image PNG file, and then you can just dump it into PowerPoint from there. So, yes, Richard? Well, thank you. Yeah. Actually, I wanted to tell you, Dr. Frieden, we presented this to him a year ago, and he was really excited about it. He uses Whiskers all the time, and he tells all these other centers at CDC that they need to have something like Whiskers, you know. But he was asking, you know, how long is it going to take to get this out? And I think he was expecting me to say, oh, about 3 months, you know. So when I told him it was January 2014, he just kind of rolled his eyes. He said, you got to be kidding. We got high school kids working these things out in their basement and releasing it the next day, you know. And I felt like saying, yeah?
Maybe you need to do the website for
ACA. That's right. Anyway, so we told him that this is going to be available, and I know he's going to be excited about it too. And he's got a real commitment to mobile applications, so he's got actually set up a lab, a mobile lab at CDC, which is helping us develop this as well and figure out all the details of getting it out on the street. So it's going to be the movement of the future, and there's actually nothing else like this out there that I've seen. I talked to some people in the communications office at CDC, and they said nobody has anything like this. So it's cutting edge, so it's exciting. Yes, Ted? No.
Which means that when you show the leading causes of death, you've actually left a chunk of injury out. And I think that's unwise. And it gets very confusing for reporters because things don't add up.
Well, I mean, it's collapsed down. I mean, we're just using the leading cause charts are based on the leading causes that have been defined by NCHS. So there's not much we can do about that. However, you can go to Whiskers and you can look at everything by intent. So it's not, and we're not hiding anything. It's just that we're just providing a brief overview for the injury field to introduce injuries to other people that don't know about injuries. So it's not a all do all to end all. And, you know, we can certainly expand it out. And there has been some suggestion about adding other leading cause charts that might focus down on different things. So this is just a proof of concept, and we're going to put it out there. We didn't want to spend too much of taxpayers' money and just see how it works out, see if people are going to use it. And if so, we'll go further. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Maybe I just have to be patient. All right. Well, I actually am going to be speaking a little bit about a proposed framework that we've put together for classifying ICD-10-CM coded data. So as those of you who work with administrative data sets know, in October of 2014 is when most of the hospitals and emergency departments are supposed to begin coding their data in ICD-10-CM. And so clearly there's a lot of concern and interest in sort of the ICD-10-CM because people have gotten accustomed to using the 9-CM coded data, and now we're moving to this world of 10-CM. And I was just going to ask you, how many of you work with coded data, the ICD coded data from hospitals or from, okay. So good to know. And last year, during this roundtable discussion, Lee had presented the draft matrix that we had created around external causes. So there's actually two matrices, one that looks at external cause, which takes the ICD codes and sort of breaks them down by nature or mechanism of injury and by intentionality, and that's the discussion that Lee had last year. Just as follow-up to sort of that particular piece of work, we got a lot of feedback from folks after that presentation last year, and that was incorporated into the matrix. We actually have a manuscript that we've written as well as the Excel tables for that external cause code matrix. It's gone through CDC clearance, and we're hoping to have that posted to the web by January. So people will have a chance to see the full proposed external cause matrix early on before this coded data sort of comes around in October of 2014. But clearly it was with your input that we were able to sort of get that going. So look for that in January or so. Look for the link to the external cause ICD-10-CM matrix. The other sort of matrix that's out there is one that's on diagnosis codes. And the diagnosis codes are nature of injury by body region. So probably the diagnosis matrix is used less frequently than the external cause matrix. So for those of you who work with injury, how many of you really focus on the injury diagnosis more than the mechanism of injury? Okay. Excuse me? Yeah, yeah. So what I'm going to be talking about is the diagnosis matrix. And in this presentation, I'm going to talk real briefly about the differences between the 9-CM codes and the 10-CM codes, and then talk about the existing matrices. So there's a matrix for the diagnosis codes that's known as the Burrell matrix, and it's for ICD-9-CM. And then there's another matrix for injury mortality, known as the injury mortality diagnosis matrix. And that's in ICD-10, but keep in mind the ICD-10 codes are for deaths, whereas ICD-10-CM is more for morbidity, so more the hospitalization and emergency department world. I'm going to talk to you about the process that was used to come up with this draft and then how we made choices with regard to placing the codes into the cells of the matrix. And then if there's time, I'd like to have a brief discussion or be able to connect with those folks who are most interested in this diagnosis matrix. So as I mentioned in the diagnosis codes themselves actually classify injuries by body region, such as the head or the abdomen or extremities, and then by the nature of injury, so fractures, lacerations, organ injuries, those types of things. In contrast, the matrices are used to sort of assign these injury codes into clinical meaningful clinically meaningful categories for standardized comparisons. And one of the big concerns in moving to ICD-10-CM is whether or not the results shown in this new matrix will be comparable to what was in ICD-9-CM, and also how will it sort of compare to what's in ICD-10. So as I sort of talk to you about how the new matrix was developed, keep that in mind, because what we were trying to do is sort of see comparability over time. In talking about the nature of injury codes themselves, for those of you who use the ICD-9-CM, that's in Chapter 17, and the structure of the code is in 800 to 995 range. ICD-10, the structure of the codes have totally changed. They're now found in Chapter 19. They're S&T codes the ICD-10. And there's been a substantial increase in the number of diagnosis codes in 10 and 10-CM compared to what was in ICD-9. So, for example, there's now 5 times as many diagnosis codes in ICD-10-CM than there was in 9-CM. But more importantly, in the injury arena, in moving from 9 to 10, there was a major restructuring of the injury codes and actually the axis that's used to define the codes. Let me talk a little bit about the code structure, and then I'll talk about this axis change. So in 9-CM, the ICD-9-CM codes were 3 to 5 characters. Normally, the first character is a number, except for a couple cases where it starts with an E, so the external cause codes, or a V. Characters 2 through 5 were numeric, and there's typically a decimal after the third character. In ICD-10-CM, you can see that the number of codes has increased from around 14,000 to close to 70,000 codes. And the codes have actually become much longer. So instead of having a maximum of 5 characters, you now have up to 7 characters. The first character is always a letter. The second character is always numeric. And then characters 3 through 7 are either alpha or numeric. And just as with ICD-9-CM, there's a decimal after the third character. What's sort of interesting or new in the ICD-10 and 10-CM world is there's this dummy placeholder. There are X characters sort of embedded in the code with the idea that as time goes on and we realize, oh, we need a code for this, or, oh, here's a new characteristic we want to describe, then there's sort of a placeholder where that sort of information could be captured. So it'll be a standard in some of these codes that there's an X character embedded in the midst of the code. The other thing is that the 7th character of these longer codes describe a timing factor. So whether or not this was a diagnosis that was made during an initial visit, whether or not it was assigned during a subsequent or follow-up visit, or whether this is a sequelae from a previous, it's a sequelae of that particular injury diagnosis. So there are some new concepts that are sort of wrapped up into these 10-CM codes. I mentioned that there's a change in the axis of how these codes were designed. So if we look back in ICD-9, it was really based on the nature of injury. So the way that the codes were sort of set up is you talk about all fractures, and then they would talk about the body regions within that set of fractures. So the 800 codes were skull fractures, and then you would have clavicle fractures and spine fractures and on and on and on in terms of fractures. In ICD-10, they totally flipped the axis. So what they did then is instead of talking about the nature of the nature of injury, they ended up talking about the body region first. So you can see from the coding structure here that all the injuries to the head are sort of grouped together, all the injuries to the neck are grouped together, all the injuries to the thorax are grouped together. So certainly in terms of building the matrix, it makes it a lot easier because that's sort of similar, much more similar to sort of the layout of how these matrices were developed. In 10-CM, the type of injury is specified in the third character. So here's sort of a list of what you can see in terms of the types of injuries that are sort of standardly captured in the ICD-10-CM. So it goes from superficial injuries with a third character of 0, to fractures with a third character of 2, blood vessel injuries, nerve injuries, all types of different things. And so when you combine those two together and you look here, you can see that by knowing the coding schema and knowing the position of the particular character, you can quickly sort of impress your friends with what this code is by knowing that every time the third character is a zero, you got a superficial injury. Okay, so if the third character is a one, you have an open wound. If the third character is a two, you have a fracture. So hopefully that will make it simpler to sort of understand at least the first three characters in the codes. Let me move away from the codes themselves and now talk about the existing existing matrices. For the ICD-9-CM, it was a matrix that's popularly known as the Borel matrix because there was an international group that had worked on it to put it together, and a researcher from Israel, Vita Borel, spent a lot of work on it, and so it's been named after her. And so it's popularly known as the Borel matrix. There's a second matrix that is sort of out and being used, and that's for ICD-10, which again is for mortality. It's for the death certificates, and that's the injury mortality diagnosis matrix. For both of these matrices, the layout is fairly similar. So if you look over on the right-hand side, you'll see that it's all the different body regions are sort of listed. And if you look there, you see that there's actually multiple levels to these body regions. So the major categories are things like head and neck, spine and upper back, torso, that type of thing, extremities. And then there's a second level that sort of goes into greater detail. If you look across the columns, you'll see that the columns are labeled by the nature of injury. So that's where you have the fractures, dislocations, internal organ injuries, those types of things. So it's within that world of the layout of the matrix or the layout of the framework that all of these individual ICD codes are placed within all of those different cells. And sort of the position of those codes in the Borel matrix are fairly similar, although some differences with the IMD matrix. But in any event, this is sort of the structure that we're headed towards with the ICD-10-CM. There are some differences between these two matrices, and it's important to sort of think about that as we think about the structure of the 10-CM matrix. So probably the most important difference between the two is that the Borel matrix is meant for ICD-9-CM coded data, which is morbidity data. And clearly, you're going to have a lot more detail, a lot more needed diagnoses in a world where you're looking at hospitalizations, emergency department visits, that type of thing, than what you might need in a mortality data set. So ICD-10 is for deaths. And clearly, you want to know the underlying and contributory causes of death, but the level of detail of whether or not it was the right eardrum or the left eardrum probably is less necessary when it comes to the death data. There's a little bit of difference in the structure of these matrices. There are some unique nature of injury columns in the ICD-9-CM Borel matrix. So there are some columns specifically to injuries involving sprains and strains. And as you can imagine, on death, that's probably not too many people die of a sprained finger, but maybe it happens, but in any event, it wasn't included as a column on the IMD matrix. And the same thing with nervous injuries, or injuries to nerves. In contrast, on the IMD matrix, there's a bunch of different categories that aren't found in the Borel matrix, and most of these are things related to poisonings or toxic effects, those types of things. So the structure is a little different between these two matrices. When you look at the body region rows, in the Borel matrix, there's actually a third layer when it comes to the body regions, and it includes different particular subcategories of traumatic brain injury. And it has to do with whether or not there's both an intracranial injury and loss of consciousness, if there's only loss of consciousness, or if there's a skull fracture with no loss of consciousness. And that's what the type 1, type 2, and type 3 are all about. In the IMD, again, these are deaths, so probably the subtleties of all those different TBIs aren't really necessary. When it comes to the codes themselves, how they're distributed in these two matrices differ slightly. I don't know that this is incredibly important right now, but you know, as I was trying to sort of highlight the differences, I felt like I shouldn't sort of just leave them off. But in any event, frostbite is sort of scattered differently throughout the two matrices, and then how sequelae codes are used differ in the two matrices. So that's a little bit of background about sort of what was in existence. And so the question is, okay, now we got to work on the ICD-10-CM matrix. So what should we do? Should we make it match 9 cm? Because it's morbidity data, it's going to be used in hospitals and emergency departments, and so when we're thinking about time trends, we want to make sure that we're sort of in agreement through that time period. But the actual code structure itself is much more like ICD-10. So, and when 9 cm goes away, we're going to be working in an ICD-10 based world. So we don't want to be too far away from ICD-10 matrix, because that's, you know, that's the world that we'll be using when we're talking about comparisons between fatal and non-fatal injuries. So after sort of going through and looking at all of these differences between the two, what we decided to do is to begin with the IMD matrix and use that sort of as our core, but that we would add rows and columns to the matrix as needed for comparability to the Burrell matrix. So I want to just show you some quick examples of how that sort of worked. This is body region level 1, okay, and the top box over on the right-hand side is sort of the six main categories that are in the ICD-10 matrix. At the bottom box on the right-hand side shows you the five main categories that are in the ICD-9 cm or Burrell matrix, and basically, you know, if you look at them, they're not that different. So this was pretty easy to sort of say, you know what, let's just stick with the ICD-10 cm list of the five primary body region categories. So that's what's being proposed. It gets a little more tricky when you move to the next body region level. So I want to give you an example here. This is just looking in the world of the head and neck. And I want to talk about level 2 and level 3 in terms of the body regions. So again, at the top on the right, you'll see that for the IMD matrix for deaths, there's only a level 2, there's no level 3. And in that particular matrix, what the categories are traumatic brain injury, other head injuries, other neck, and head and neck other, and that has to do with the structure of the codes. When we look at the Burrell matrix, the 9 cm matrix, there's actually two levels, level 2 and level 3, when it comes to the body regions. And so at the level 2 level, there's traumatic brain injury and other head, face, and neck. Traumatic brain injury in the Burrell matrix, as I mentioned before, is broken down into three types of TBI. Other head, face, and neck is broken down into other head, face, eye, neck, and head, face, and neck unspecified. So you can see that when we compare the 10 with the 9 cm, there's a lot of similarities, but there are some things that are different. So we ended up sort of with a blending, and you can see over there in the red box sort of our proposed, where we would have two additional levels, level 2 and level 3. Level 2 would be broken down into traumatic brain injury and other head, face, and neck. And then the category of other head, face, and neck would be broken down into face, eye, other head, and neck. Okay, so again, sort of a blending between the two matrices. I'm not going to go through this for every single body region. I'm just going to show you sort of our endpoint and what we've been proposing. But it really is based on the same sort of process, looking at the two and sort of coming up with a blend if needed. So this is a body region of spine and upper back. Here we have two categories at the level 2, spinal cord injury and vertebral column injury. And then both of these are broken up into cervical, thoracic, lumbar, and sacrococcygeal. This is very similar to as it is in the IMD and in the Burrell matrix. The next body region is torso. And here at level 2, we have chest, abdomen, pelvis, and other trunk. Right now, we've got pelvis broken up into some subcategories here, but that still is under discussion. Part of it is, will people actually need to use this level of categorization or not? But in any event, the ICD-10 cm codes are so well designed that it's easy enough to sort of group them this way if it ends up being of interest and of need to have commonality in those groupings. Here's the body region related to extremities. Again, there's upper extremity and lower extremity as the two large level 2 groups, and then each of those are broken down into what seems appropriate: shoulder, forearm, wrist, arm, not further specified for the upper extremity, and then hip, upper leg and thigh, knee, lower leg, so on for the lower extremity. And then the final body region is unclassifiable by body region. These are for those codes that actually describe things in multiple body regions. There aren't that many codes, but there are a few. and then system-wide. So these are the sort of poisonings and toxic effects where it isn't a single body region that's involved. It actually involves the whole body. So that's what we had for the body regions. Now let's sort of turn our attention to the columns. So these are the nature of injury. And this one was actually really easy to do because you saw the structure of the codes. It's sort of like laying out there for you, easy enough to sort of put them into a particular location. So our decision was that we would keep all of the nature of injury categories as in the IMD matrix. There were a few things, because of the specificities of the codes, that we could actually sort of divide them out at a second level of nature of injury. So there's actually two separate columns for burns versus corrosions, three separate columns currently for poisoning, adverse effects, and underdosing, and then three separate columns for sprains, nerves, and muscle and tendon injuries. Let me just make a note here. It's interesting, in the ICD-10-CM, there's a set of codes that are for underdosing, meaning people having problems because they aren't taking enough of their medication. And so I think we as an injury community sort of need to have some conversation about, do we include those in the world of poison, or excuse me, of injuries? I mean, clearly we've kept poisonings in our world of injuries for a long time. So if you're taking too much of a medication and it causes a bad effect, then poisonings are definitely sort of in the world that we've considered. But whether or not underdosing ought to be included in the world of injury, I think is worth having a discussion about. So here's just the laundry list of all the nature of injury columns that will be in the matrix. And as I mentioned, those are the three categories there that will have some sub-levels to them. So I want to talk for a moment about placing the codes within the cells of the matrix. And what we had decided to do was that initially we would take all these codes and sort of place them in the same relative location as where they sat in the ICD-10 IMD matrix. But for some of these codes, there's a lot more information available. And so there were times where they landed that was comparable to the IMD matrix wasn't really the best location for them. So we came up with a couple rules about, well, if we're going to move them out of that box, out of that cell, how are we going to do it? And so our rule was, well, if you're going to move it someplace, let's look and see what the GEMS equivalent in 9CM was and see where that code would have been located in the Borel matrix. And then there was also a need for sort of internal consistency within the 10CM matrix. So I'm going to show you just some real quick examples of when we move things around. Yeah, I'll do that. And let me just say that there's over 12,000 injury diagnosis codes, and it took a while to go through them all and make sure they were in the right home. So if I didn't capture all those that need to go to a new home, that's why I want folks to take a look at this matrix and see if they see something that I might have missed. So. Lee reminded me to sort of talk a little bit about the GEMS. The GEMS, it's not a crosswalk. GEMS stands for General Equivalence Mapping. And so it's a way of trying to sort of say this world of codes, what would be the comparable codes, or where would you sort of go look for similar codes in a different coding schema. So there are GEMS that go from 9CM to 10CM. There are GEMS that go from 10CM back to 9CM. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm sort of saying we're trying to find out where would a comparable code have gone in the different matrix. So here's an example of a code that was in a certain location in the IMD matrix that we moved to a different location. And this is injury to the brachial plexus, S14.3. So the brachial plexus is a large complex of nerves that sort of comes out of the neck and goes down into the arm and creates all the nerves that go down into the arm. So in the IMD matrix, that particular code was listed in head and neck. And because there's no category for nerve-related injuries in the IMD matrix, the nature of injury for that was other specified injury. Well, clearly there's a lot more detail there than just being going into other specified injury. And when we looked at this particular code, we used the GEMS to look at the comparable code 953.4 in the ICD-9CM. That particular code was actually coded not to head and neck, but to the extremities. And then the nature of injury was nerves. And so since that seemed much more specific than where it had been located in the ICD-10 matrix, our recommendation is to follow the 9CM matrix and move it to a new location. So that would mean this code S14.3 would be in different locations in the death matrix compared to the morbidity matrix. Here's another example, S15.1X, injury to the vertebral artery. The vertebral artery, again, sort of comes out of the head and neck, and it's a rather large artery and important for your brain. But in any event, this code in the IMD matrix went in the body region of spine and upper back. Nature of injury was blood vessel. When we used the GEMS to find the equivalent code, that one was located in head and neck. So rather than locating this particular code in the world of the spine and upper back, our recommendation is that we move it to the head and neck body region. Here's another example of a change in cell placement. This has to do with greater specificity in the code. And as I mentioned, ICD-10-CM allows you to get very refined in terms of your diagnoses. And there actually is a very specific code, T28.411, burn of the right eardrum. It'll be interesting to see, once we have coded data, how often this code gets assigned. But in any event, the parent code for this particular injury, T28.4, is a category known as burns of other and unspecified internal organs. And so because of that other and unspecified, it got placed in the body region of unspecified. But clearly, the code itself gives you a lot more detail to be able to say, you know what, I think this belongs in head and neck. And so our recommendation is we move it to head and neck with a body level 2 of other head, face, and neck, and a body level 3 of other head. So that's what we've suggested. So where we're at right now is we have this draft matrix. I'm looking for folks who might want to review it, might want to look at it. I've got a series of questions that I'm trying to sort of get some answers to or would like to have some discussion about. I recognize that not everyone here is heavy duty into diagnosis and anatomy and all that sort of thing, so I won't bore everyone with the conversation now, but if any of you have an interest in this diagnosis matrix or would be interested in taking a look at it, please meet with me after the session, because I'm trying to get a list of names of interested individuals so that we can start having some conference calls and sort of finalizing this particular matrix. But these are the types of things that I would like to discuss with the group. So first of all, is the basic framework acceptable? Does it seem like it might meet people's needs and be reasonably comparable to the 9CM and the 10 matrix? And then within the matrix that's being proposed, you know, are there some things that we should tweak or make different or better? We've got some issues with traumatic brain injury. Traumatic brain injury is a very high profile injury with lots of interest. And so messing around with the ICD codes that are used to define it makes people really nervous. So we actually have a working group pulled together from NCIPC and from NCHS. We've been meeting for the past year, looking at all these different head injury related codes and coming up with some suggestions and recommendations about that. And we have a draft that we've put together. We're planning to sort of write that up and sort of begin the distribution and send it out to other federal agencies, to academic institutions and other folks who really work on traumatic brain injury to get their input on that before we sort of finalize it. But just as a heads up, I hadn't thought about that, a heads up about the TBI mortality, is that there are some codes in TBI mortality that we aren't including in TBI morbidity. And they have to do with a lot of injuries to the face that, if you're on the death certificate with that injury to the face, there's some thought that, well, maybe there was a head injury as well. And because if you don't have a CT scan or you don't have all the other sorts of major diagnostic things. So, but when it comes to hospitalizations and ED, we feel like there ought to be enough ways of being able to determine the exact diagnosis that these sort of face-related codes shouldn't be part of the TBI diagnosis. There are some questions that I have with regard to these two things, sacral fractures and spinal cord injury. Sacral fractures, because the sacrum and the coccyx are actually sometimes considered part of the spinal column, they've been included in spine and upper back in both the IMD matrix and the Borel matrix. But it sort of leaves a giant gap when you're trying to look at all the pelvic injuries, because the sacrum is actually part of the bony pelvis as well. So is it time to revisit that conversation about where sacral fractures should go? Should they really go along with the spine-related codes, or should they sort of move into the pelvis-related codes? And then on spinal cord injury, I don't know the reasoning behind this. I need to explore this a little bit more. But spinal cord injuries have been placed into the category of internal organs rather than nerves. And I'd like to learn why the largest nerve in the body is not included with the nerves. And then the final issue then now is how will these sequelae codes be handled? So I don't know if you remember, I mentioned that the ICD-10-CM codes, they have a seventh digit that tell you if it's the initial visit or a follow-up visit or a sequelae. When we had this discussion with the external cause matrix, our decision was that we wouldn't include any of the sequelae codes or the follow-up visit codes as part of the matrix. And I'm assuming we'll probably do something similar to that with the diagnosis matrix. But again, it's worth having the conversation with a larger community about that. So here's where we are. We're going to finalize the current draft. And I'd like comments at this point as well. And then distribute it for review and comment. And then my hope is that beginning early in next year, we can sort of prepare the manuscript describing the process and the final draft. And then have that out for people to be able to look at and be aware of prior to October of 2014, when the coding world sort of changes for all of us. And of course, all of this is still draft until we actually have some ICD-10-CM coded data. Once we have the data, we can start looking at the trends over time of these different things and see whether or not how the matrix is working and if we need to make any tweaks to it. So again, look forward to any comments that any of you have, and please meet me afterwards if you have an interest in looking at the draft matrix. Okay, that's it. Yeah, Ted.
Yeah. The TBI decomposition in the Borel matrix actually validated very well and proved very useful as regression variables for things like predicting disability and resource use. I'm curious whether we're moving away from that because we no longer get the codes needed to compute it, and if so, whether we need to be going back to Donna, pick it over here, and saying, we want to change CM to get that information.
I have to admit that I've been working with the TBI group at CDC, so I've been really sort of guided by what their comments are. They did not see the need for the separation of the three levels of TBI. And a lot of the detail in the 9CM codes with regard to the length of time of unconsciousness, so you know, there are some extensions on those 9CM codes that tell you they were unconscious for short length of time or less than 30 minutes or 24 hours and no recovery. Those are actually captured, I believe, in other codes within 10CM. So they aren't in, so there's a separate sort of world of codes that aren't in the S&T chapters that tell you about that level of consciousness. And Donna, are there codes that tell you about recovery after? And this is Donna Pickett from the National Center for Health Statistics. She's all things ICD-10-CM. Sorry. Yeah. All right. So I think, Margie, if you want to come up, we'll sort of keep moving here.
Thanks. It's so quiet. I am really pleased to be here today to talk to you about ways to improve fatal injury data, surveillance by outreach to the medical examiner and coroners. All the data Lee showed you, he mentioned, was from the National Vital Statistics System, and I'm actually working now in that office within CDC at National Center for Health Statistics, where we compile the death certificate data or the National Vital Statistics System system, mortality file, multiple cause of death. You know, that's the official title. Most people know it as the CDC death data. It's what's on Wonder, it's what's on Whiskers, and it's used in many other applications. NIOSH uses it, for instance. But you may wonder why I'm here talking about outreach to medical examiners and coroners and what that has to do with you as injury researchers. And I really want to make sure that you know that most injury data does have reached the medical examiner and coroners. They are the ones that are reviewing most injury deaths, all homicides, all suicides, and many unintentional injury deaths where the death occurs outside the hospital setting. The medical examiner or coroner will investigate that death. So in a sense, the medical examiner and coroners are collecting data for us because they are reviewing the death, they are documenting what happened, they are doing autopsies, they're collating all the information together for us and writing it down, and we should really be thanking them for that work they're doing for us. And I think often we, in CDC and public health, we don't actually appreciate that quite enough. So CDC is working now to outreach to medical examiners and coroners and trying to get the message back how much we appreciate their work. And ultimately, we hope that that'll work towards increasing the quality of our data, as well as the timeliness, which, as Lee mentioned, is actually a problem, not necessarily a problem from the medical examiner and coroner's standpoint. So, with that, this one. Okay, I have nothing to disclose. I work for the government. They won't let me do anything like that. So today I'm going to start out by talking a little bit about fatal injury data from medical examiners and coroners. I'm just going to give you an overview. People always ask me, you know, what's the difference between a medical examiner and coroner? What deaths do they investigate? All kinds of questions like that. I'm going to talk about some of the efforts to improve death investigation in the U.S. in general. And then I'm going to talk about our new CDC NCHS program, which I'm heading up. And I'd love to talk to you for ages and ages about that, but I can't do that. And then I want to just reach out to you all to talk about what the Injury Control and Emergency Health Services section can help with this outreach effort. So in my view of the world, this is a Venn diagram. I'm helping my sixth grader with his homework a lot, and he's doing Venn diagrams, so I'm using one in this session. The death investigation data is the universe of all death investigation information on deaths. So that would include information from police, from EMS, from the hospital if they went to a hospital, from PDMP data, for instance, would be if a death involved drugs. So that's all the death investigation data that's out there. That's the largest circle. That's the universe of information. And then within that, we have the medical and coroner death investigation data. And I'll talk a little bit about what I'm including in that data in the next few slides. Then within that data is my data, the death certificate data. It's not my data, but that's the part I work on. The death certificates are, I'll show you a death. Well, I don't have a picture of a death certificate, but maybe you've seen one. But that's where the medical examiner and coroner are summarizing all the information from the death investigation they're doing. They summarize it very nicely for us in the cause of death statement. And it's really, we should be thanking them for that because it's just a huge mass of stuff that they summarize down into, you know, very concise terms. Then we take the state death certificate data at CDC. We compile it, all the standard data items that are standard from the U.S., from the certificates within the state. Not every state uses the same certificate. We compile it down into a death certificate data file that you can use. An important place between the death certificate and the CDC data is death certificate data file is the coding of the data from text data to ICD-10, now coded data, ICD-11 sometime in the future. So here's my picture of what a medical examiner or coroner is doing. They investigate a death. So one of the things they look at is the death scene investigation. Oftentimes now, they have death investigators going out, not necessarily the medical and coroner themselves, but actually trained professionals go out and investigate the scene, and they have credentialing for some states for those death investigators. They may or may not do an autopsy, and actually medical examiner and coroners do very many more autopsies than in the hospital, say. The rate is not going down like it is in the rest of the, or at the same rate as it is within the hospital setting. They may use toxicology, DNA findings, and other kinds of tests like CT scans and to get all the information about the death. Then they will record it, like I mentioned, either in a paper file, in a computer electronic file, or in a combination of the two, more like a case log in a computer with a paper file to go back and chase down the further information, to write more detailed information. Then they're summarizing it. In the back there I have the death certificate, and they're summarizing it down. So what types of deaths do they investigate? Those occurring, these are sort of the general types of deaths that are investigated. Each state has different rules and regulations, but in general, these are the types of deaths that are investigating across this country. Those occurring in under unusual or suspicious circumstances, obviously we want to look at those. Non-natural deaths, so unintentional deaths, homicides, suicides, sudden unexpected deaths, particularly in younger people. Unattended deaths, so if a death occurs at home, not under medical supervision, and particularly when the decedent isn't being treated by a physician for a particular condition already. And then there are other statutory requirements by state, and each medical examiner coroner may have their own types of death that they look at besides these. So the other question, as I said, what's the difference between a medical examiner and a coroner? Some people, I'm sure, know this, but I'll go over it anyway. Medical examiners are generally physicians. There's no absolutes in any of this, let me tell you. But generally, they have medical degrees, and often forensic pathologists, so way beyond just standard training. They're generally appointed by some official within the state. They can be medical examiners can be based in a county or based in a state. Coroners often have no medical background, although sometimes they do, and sometimes they're forensic pathologists. Some states and counties require certification, and that's becoming more and more common. The certification is generally like 40 hours of training. But in four states, there's still no training requirement whatsoever, no degree requirement. They're often elected, although 20% are appointed. So as you can tell, just all over the board. In medical death investigation systems, so this by this I mean sort of within a state or a county what it looks like, the death investigation systems and procedures are governed by state and county laws and regulations. There's over 2,000 different medical investigation. I used the word jurisdiction here, but you could replace offices. So offices that do the medical death investigation, 2,000. So you can just think of how hard it would be to it will be to standardize the practices. Variation includes, again, medical examiner coroner, state-based or county-based. Some states have state MEs. Some offices are located in health departments, most offices, I think. Others are located in law enforcement. And some offices have university affiliations. And I mention the university affiliation because medical examiners feel that it may help help them to do their research depending on where they're located, research in forensic science, and if you're located in a university, it facilitates research for a variety of different reasons. So here's our state map, and I wrote down, just to make sure I get it right, 18 states have centralized state-based MEs, 11 states have coroners in only within the state, no medical examiners. The remainder have a mixture of both. And there's a star down there, the asterisk. Those states have state MEs. So it's a little confusing. But what we've done, or what I'm working with the public health law program at CDC, and we're going through all the state statutes in each of the states, and they're looking through and looking through the state statutes to determine which states have medical examiners, coroners, all these different questions I went through, who's elected, who's not elected, or appointed. We're looking at which states, what deaths are required to be autopsied, what deaths are required to be investigated, just a whole host of questions. And we're almost done with that, and it's almost through clearance, and we're getting ready to put it on the web. It's going to be kind of hard to get it on the web because there's so many different questions, so many different states, but it should be available maybe January, and then you can look at it. This has been done in the past, but not recently, and it's not up on the web as it will be, and I'm hoping that it'll help stimulate some discussion, and it's good that it'll be easily accessible by anybody who wants to know the information. And maybe somebody here wants to do some research, say, in how death reporting it varies by state based on the types of death investigation systems they have. So I don't want to be all sad and, you know, we can't make any comparisons between our states because we lack standardization. That's just not true. We have lots of examples of data sharing between federal, state, and local partners. The National Vital Statistics System, we do at CDC. We work a lot on different standardization issues. And states within a state, many states are actually working on, state vital statistics departments are working on improving the quality. There's been a lot of focus on timeliness, but there's now starting to be a little bit more focus on quality. National Violent Death Reporting System, I don't think I have to talk to you about that. Child Death Review, Maternal Death Review, Maternal Mortality Death Review, FARS, the Medical Examiner Coroner Alert Project, CPSC runs, MedWatch, the FDA runs. It's just a whole host of ways we're getting data from medical examiner and coroners. So what are we doing to improve? This is more of a national level look at what we're doing as a country, not we in this room, but you know, there's a lot of interest in this beyond public health. So there's been many recommendations over the years from different expert panels, but there's a report in 2009 put together by the National Academy of Sciences called Strengthening Forensic Science as a Path Forward, and medical death investigation falls within the forensic sciences. And there's a whole chapter of this book, Chapter 7, which is all about medical death investigation. It's really fascinating. It's available for free on the web, so if you want to look at it, you can look it up. But they require, they're recommending, you know, crazy things like requiring certification for professionals in this field, requiring that autopsies be done by a board-certified forensic pathologist, and obviously funds are a huge issue for medical examiner and coroners. There was also a investigation done by National Public Radio, ProPublica, and Frontline. And this seems to come up in the strangest places for me when I tell people what I'm doing. I think this investigative reporting really had an impact on sort of the psyche of the country. You know, my mom mentioned it to me. So, you know, not often the cocktail level conversation, but it was so fascinating what they showed. You can read it, look at it you want. I'm assuming because it's NPR and ProPublica, you know, it's somewhat reasonable journalism. And it seems to fit with the other stuff I've read, but it's good fun. Well, not fun, but... So one of the other things that came out from that National Academy of Sciences report, the NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, and the National Institute of Justice are going to partner to form a new commission on the forensic sciences. And this is all brand new. It was just announced in February 2013, but medical death investigation will definitely be under this National Commission on Forensic Sciences. Now, national commissions can have no impact, no direct regulatory role in this because in medical death investigation because it's all done at a state level, but certainly it may make a difference what they recommend. And the Standards Institute is there to try to get standards around death investigation. So other federal involvement, CDC, National Academy of Sciences, National Institute of Health, and there are others too. There are professional associations work a little bit around standard setting and certification, and these are just a couple. Most people know National Association of Medical Examiners. There's the International Association of Coronary Medical Examiners that's really become quite active, and also the American Board of Medical Legal Death Investigators, and the investigators are the ones that are going out and doing the death scene investigation, and they're coming up with their own set of protocol, or not protocol, but certification standards, classes, trainings on all how to investigate all kinds of different deaths. Because it's not easy. You have to look for different things for different causes of death. And of course, there's state-based professional associations as well. So I'm going to talk a little bit about our program at CDC. CDC was involved in the past from 1986 to 2004. There was a medical examiner coronary information sharing project at CDC. I don't know whether any of you are familiar with this, but this program. But they did a lot of work and a lot of reach out to medical examiner and coroners. It's kind of a shame it went away through reshuffling at CDC, and then nobody picked up the work that it was picked up by a variety of different CDC CIOs instead of being centered in one place. And many people miss it, including the medical examiner and coroner community themselves, which I think is important. It shows you that we were providing a service to them, not just for us. So, and CHS agreed to try to pick up the slack here, and so we're working to improve national mortality surveillance by we're going to be promoting quality and consistency in death investigation, enhancing the efficiency of data collection. You know, this is really in our best interest, but it's in the best interest of standardization within a medical examiner coroner office themselves, and they like to look at their own data. Facilitating information sharing among medical death investigators and also coordinating public health surveillance efforts. So, you know, there's lots of different federal agencies going and knocking on the doors of medical examiner and coroners. You know, FARS goes over to them, MECAP, CPSC knocks on their door, CDC, NVDRS, the SUID registries. You know, there's now going to be this new sudden, maybe you don't know this, and I don't remember the exact acronym, the Sudden Death in the Young Registry that the National Institute of Health just funded. For those of you who are interested in sudden death, some of which are injury. So we're trying, eventually hoping to try to coordinate that how we are asking for data instead of just asking, we can do it in a, you know, more consistent way. NIOSH, I heard one example from a state partner, you know, NIOSH wants something for the FACE program, and NVDRS wants something for their program, and the same investigator has to go back twice, or two different investigators go back to the same medical examiner to get the same information on the same death, which is just, you know, not that efficient for CDC, but really for the medical examiner in that state. So my question to you, and I know we have a few minutes for discussion, if anybody feels like discussing at 3:45 in the afternoon, what role can APHA and ICEHS play in this effort? And I don't know whether anybody, here's my discussion points. I'm not sure whether I'm going to get discussion today, but if anybody has any comments or questions, please let me know. I'm opening it up now. Good, Ted.
I wonder if you should be pushing some sort of resolution to the APHA policy process about this issue.
Yeah,
I... Then you get APHA itself trying to work on this issue.
I've actually thought about that. I know about zero about the APHA policy initiatives because I work at NCHS and we're not supposed to work on policy. But I think it is a good idea. And if you know how to do that, let me know. And what policy would we be saying that public health should engage?
Well, if there are certain things that you think should be done around coroner medical examiner systems, for example, if you think that we really should be pushing to convert the elected coroners to medical examiners, we could put together a paper, a policy resolution that says that and get APHA behind that, and they have a lot of influence over public health infrastructure in the states when they pass.
I remember I'm from CDC and NCHS. Yeah. We definitely can't do that.
With some of us who are on the policy committee,
well, that was,
about what we might want to consider.
That was the idea behind the, not the idea behind, but one of the reasons that I wanted the public health law program to get involved was to document all the differences between the different systems and talk about, you know, what, you know, to show it. And then there could be research, like I looked at the differences between reporting from medical examiner and coroners. That's one possibility. But sure.
Margie, as a forensic pathologist, medical examiner, and the executive vice president of the National Association of Medical Examiners, I'm delighted by your presentation, and I'd like to respond to this gentleman over here and say that the National Association of Medical Examiners would be delighted that APHA would make a policy statement about converting coroner systems to medical examiner systems. And there is substantial differences in the quality of data that come out of the different sorts of systems. And Margie just sort of touched on it, but in general, coroner systems are directed by individuals who are 18 years old and registered to vote. 18 years old, registered to vote, never fought a duel. 18 years old, registered to vote, never renounced the Supreme Being. And medical examiner systems are professionalized systems, by and large, with board certified. And the more oomph we have behind the National Academy of Sciences report by other professional societies, the more likely we will be to get things like modern medical examiner legislation, which last took place in 1954 and is now obsolete. And so NAME has been trying to work with other professional societies, for example, the College of American Pathologists, Medical Association. I think
say what a scandal some of the death investigation is in this country. And I make it a requirement all my students have to watch that front line. Anyone that does any analysis of mortality data in this country should watch that front line thing as a quick overview just to show you what a shambles it is in terms of how it's going to differ major categories. And this whole poisoning epidemic is all over the place as to whether they're undetermined intents or whether they're accidental deaths or whatever we want to call them. And I think
I would also say that getting NIST, that Forensic Sciences Commission, I think if they start making recommendations about what kind of training, you know, whatever you label the person, they need to have a certain training and goodness sakes, a college degree, you know, or I don't know. That's debatable because whatever you do, it costs money, and you know that's part of it, the heart of this. But that's what I wanted to say about that. Did you?
I'm just wondering how the medical examiners feel about having a national electronic death record system in the United States. Any deal about that, because that would certainly help speed things up and could contribute immensely to the efficiency of getting that data.
Well, Kurt can probably speak to this a little bit more, but let me tell you what I have started looking at that, and there are many, many states where the coroner does have, and medical examiners do have electronic data already, and we are getting electronic death certificate data. And there is a system like you're talking about in Australia already, where all the coroners are tied together and are they're not only feeding information to all these different the Australian equivalent of NHTSA or FARS or NHTSA or FDA, they're also contributing to the vital statistics system. But I don't know, Kurt, does the National Association of Medical Examiners have there been many discussions on creating an electronic system that would tie between medical examiner systems, between states, well, between counties and between states?
There has been no such discussion, and NAME does not have an official policy, although medical examiners have been supportive of electronic death registration in their states. For example, in New Mexico, where I work, we've been involved in electronic death certification for many years now. We're right at the beginning of the process, and in most states that have implemented electronic death registration, the medical examiners have been compliant in the process. So we're all for efficient data sharing. I think Marty gave a good example of what it's like to be a medical examiner and be continually hit by multiple silos of surveillance that are uncoordinated. And we think that it's important that public health practitioners fish in our pond, but it needs to be a coordinated process. So we would be supportive of anything that would make it more efficient and that would create more uniform surveillance models, for example, for injury-related deaths, rather than, you know, the silo or just looking at the NBDRS deaths, and then somebody comes along and they go look at sudden expected death and epilepsy, and now sudden expected death and epilepsy is being put together with sudden cardiac death and a sudden unexpected death model. Right? And meanwhile, the infectious disease pathology branch at CDC wants to look for emerging infections and infections of public health importance, which overlaps with the sudden unexpected death. I mean, you can see why some medical examiners and coroners get fractious and difficult to work with. But by and large, we are very supportive because, you know, there's a statement in Latin, it's a mosaic on the wall of the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, and it reads, let conversation
consensus guideline released from an expert panel on how the death certificate should be filled out for prescription opioid overdose. And I noticed that in their one paragraph summary, they used the word accidental rather than unintentional. And alarmed me that maybe NCHS wasn't sufficiently involved.
I was there. I was on. I wasn't on. And Kurt was there. It was at his office.
How do we wind up with accidental?
Because that's what's on the death certificate. That's the term the medical examiners use. Didn't you notice we were calling them drug intoxication deaths?
So we're recoding accidental with unintentional when we put it out on our tables. But accidental is what the deaths actually read?
Yes. And if you want to change the death certificate, go for it.
I didn't know.
Yes, of course, that's what's on the death certificate. And Kurt just raised his hand. Maybe he has a thought on this. But in terms of some people in death investigation might not know that unintentional and accident are the same thing. So I really wouldn't, I mean, I'm sort of joking about changing the death certificate, but I wouldn't want to do that. Or undertake it very lightly at all, because the public and some of those people are using death certificates don't think those two terms are equivalent.
Yeah, but it's really interesting. It's educational to me to learn that accidental is. I've not looked sufficiently at the death certificate since we always list unintentional to realize that that's not what it says.
Well, you should look at the death certificate. That's where that data comes from.
Bruce would say.
Yeah, Kurt has.
So they're checkboxes.
Yeah.
So there's no option for the certifier.
Right.
So the cause of death area on the death certificate is pretext.
Yes,
but the manner of death, for the circumstances under which the death occurs, you have natural checkbox, homicide, suicide, accident, and undetermined. And there are no other choices. Those are the only choices. So accident is synonymous with unintentional in medical examiner certifiers.
And I would comment that now that Kurt put it in that way, actually, accident is the least important problem in that manner of checkbox. You know, there's many more homicide, the definition of, I don't even want to get into it, but just look at the New York Times last week and look at how the variation in the way child deaths are coded for some firearm deaths. Yep. Yeah, it's another example of a manner of death.
But it doesn't get sent to.
It doesn't get sent to us in New York. They used to have that in that manner area, and we didn't. You know, our data file only allows accident or unintentional homicide, suicide. I think we're out of time, but I appreciate all the comments. And if anybody wants to come up afterwards and talk to me or email me, can I say two words about ICD-11? Okay, I didn't want to bore you.
Two words.
ICD-11 is coming. There's a handout in the back. It was supposed to be 2015 release. It's probably going to be 2017, which means we'll implement in the U.S. in 19 or 20. But is now your time to comment? It's changed.
And you should look at it.
But the good news is it's going to be more like the more ICD-11 morbidity and mortality are coordinating ahead of time. And Donna can tell you more about that. Okay, thank you for coming.